Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
All right, let's get back to Tesla for a second, dig a little deeper here. Craig Trudell, Bloomberg Global Autos editor, joins us now. So can you play this out over the last like 3 days? So Elon Musk jumps on a plane, he goes to China, then what happens?
Yeah, good morning. It has been a whirlwind couple of days, few weeks, I would say, actually. So just to go back even slightly further, Musk was supposed to go to India a little more than a week ago and called off that trip, said, he had heavy obligations at Tesla, is how he put it. Tesla proceeds to release a really crummy first quarter earnings, but Musk kind of pulls a rabbit out of a hat in announcing this change in strategy to get cheaper vehicles to market faster. How exactly he's going to do that is a little fuzzy, but the gist of it is to use existing manufacturing lines to make these new vehicles that could be ready as soon as late this year or early next year. In the process of making that pivot, he clearly needs to sort of get incremental revenue after a first quarter where sales were really weak. They had the lowest revenue since early 2022 levels, and in China, one clear way that they could do that is by offering the system that they've marketed as full self-driving in the U.S. Importantly, we should note it is not a self-driving system, but that hasn't stopped them from marketing it as such for years now.
All right, so Craig, let's focus on this weekend, which seems to be moving the stock today. Am I to understand that getting the Chinese approval for this driver assistance was up in the air, like there was a risk that they wouldn't get it, and then Elon hops on a jet, flies over, and saves the day? Is that what happened?
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily the case that this was, kind of an overnight thing. Actually, the last time that Musk was in China, this was something that we reported at the time was on the agenda. It's been something that Tesla has been after for quite some time. And it's increasingly a way that, car makers are competing in China is how advanced is your driver assistance system, that keeps you from crashing, that keeps you in your lane, that allows you in some cases to take your hands off the wheel. But in all cases, you absolutely are responsible for the car. And, no companies are taking responsibility, legal responsibility, if you get into a crash, with the exception of some, very small sort of limited fleets and contained areas. And, there are quirks, as you might imagine, by market for what is required to be able to offer these systems that really need to be safe and also need to have, controls for data collection and the cameras used to navigate the surroundings that these cars are going to need to pilot around. And that's been a hang up for Tesla and other international companies that, they need to in all cases work with local Chinese companies for things like mapping and navigation. So one of the key sort of takeaways from this trip was Tesla agreeing to do that with Baidu in China.
So who owns the stuff?
It is importantly, you know, it's a matter of ownership and where it's kept. And so, you know, this has come up years ago, actually. You know, Tesla had a bit of a hang up where their cars were banned from, you know, being in the area of military compounds and other sort of sensitive parts of China out of concerns about, you know, any information that cars were gathering. And, you know, there were concerns about whether any data was going from Tesla's China operations back to the U.S. And so Tesla needed to sort of reassure China that, you know, any data collected in China will stay in China. And so that has been, you know, something that they've had to sort of acquiesce to as of, you know, several years ago. But they needed to still sort of, you know, clear, you know, approval for you know, making sure that their T's were crossed and I's were dotted in that respect, and they needed this deal with Baidu. It does seem to be the case that they need to meet other conditions in order for FSD to be offered in China. It's still not a done deal, but what, you know, sort of hoops they still have to jump through are a bit unclear at this point. That's not stopping the market from getting very excited about this.
So how does this change, if at all, kind of the competitive landscape for Tesla in China? I know you guys have been reporting a lot how some of the local EV makers have really become very good and very competitive.
Yeah, I think it absolutely is something that's been missing for Tesla, that assuming all goes well here, you know, it will no longer be a sort of strike against them among consumers who really, you know, want the most cutting edge technology. It remains to be seen how big a deal it will be for Tesla from a revenue standpoint, because we don't know at this point how much Tesla will be willing, will be looking to charge for it. We don't know, you know, to what extent they may have to share some revenue with some of their partners. It's not clear whether Baidu maybe gets a cut. You know, in the U.S., Tesla and, you know, throughout the world, Tesla has made a point to really be, you know, want to be vertically integrated. And that's, you know, fancy talk for in control of its own destiny. They were willing to sort of acquiesce in this case, you know, I think because they really could use this boost in China at a time when their lineup is getting a bit tired and they're losing a lot of market share to companies like BYD.
Well, this also raises the question, too. It doesn't take a lot of news to get Tesla stock moving. Not that a trip to China wasn't a big deal, but like you said, there's so many questions as to the actual revenue driver and what it's going to mean. I mean, you have to wonder, you know, it's not going to take a lot for any kind of shorts, Craig, to cover.
I think that's right. And this is also a name that, you know, options traders absolutely love. It's sort of like the meme stock that has lasted as a meme stock as that craze has sort of faded away. And so, you know, anytime, to your point, you know, Musk is able to sort of get some momentum with, you know, the narrative, it tends to lead to big swings. So, you know, early this year, I think he lost control of that narrative. And, you know, it's not at all a mystery as to why that is, you know, looking at last week's earnings. But I think he was really able to sort of change what people were talking about last week. I guess we'll see whether or not, you know, this is mostly talk as opposed to, you know, going to lead to real sort of meaningful change in Tesla's earnings trajectory, which has not been trending in the right direction.
All right, Craig, thanks so much. We appreciate it. Craig Trudell, Global Autos Editor for Bloomberg News, joining us from London. You know, I follow Bloomberg's own Ed Ludlow on social media. And of course, he just got a new Tesla. And I think he uses that autonomous driving features that it has. So he's been reporting today, for example, our boy Ed, who lives in San Francisco, his full commute, about 25 miles, 3 disengagements, but 90% of the drive was under their FSD and all smooth. Hmm. His FSD made it all the way to the Golden Gate Bridge, but then had some problems about deciding which lane it wanted to choose, so Ed had to step in there. But by and large, Ed's reporting this on a daily basis. He's putting his life on the line for his primary reporting duties.
He's the best.
It looks like it's working.
I guess the question just becomes, like, how much you want to pay for it.
Right.
Like, I mean, sure, it'd be great, but is the average person, not just the tech reporter in San Francisco who also anchors a tech show, like,
right,
will the average person spend $8,000 a year for it or $100 a month?
I don't know. I mean, that kind of goes to the bigger issue of costs here. I mean, you know, it remains to be seen for Tesla investors. You know, is it tough to make? Can they make a profit at a 30,000 price limit? There's a lot of concern that they won't be able to do that. But again, Elon put out some good talk on the earnings call, trying to masking over what was a weak quarter.
True.
And then, of course, going over and having this great successful event here in China over the last 48 hours.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
You got the S&P up by about 0.4%, but it's a really busy week between eco, jobs data, the Fed, and then earnings as well. So we want to break down what is going to actually move the markets. Margi Patel, Senior Portfolio Manager at Allspring Global Investments, joins us now. So I know you're going to say all of the stuff, but let's just pin you down. So is it going to be Apple and Amazon and all the companies reporting? Is it going to be the Fed, or is it going to be the jobs data?
Oh, I think the jobs will be more important because, frankly, what the Fed has done or not done hasn't really had much of an effect on the market either way. When they talked about three cuts this year, the market was a little interested. And when the market is now saying, well, maybe they'll even raise rates, it hasn't really affected the market. The market has been looking at earnings. That's what's important. Inflation has not been a negative issue for companies. So I think it's more of the same, looking at data that shows the strength of the economy, like the jobs data.
So are you concerned that this Fed maybe got a little bit reticent here about that Fed pivot we had in December, that maybe they went a little bit too far, and maybe they'll try to compensate here this week and maybe talk a little bit more hawkish than the market's discounting?
Well, you know, that their talk seems to have swung a lot more than their actual actions. And the actions that they made, even raising rates for the last 2 years, didn't really derail the market. The market really has proven to be not so sensitive to short changes in short-term interest rates as we've seen in past cycles. So I think and particularly short rates, I think, again, corporate America is pretty much immune to the Fed's decisions. They're not over-levered. So it really, I hate to say doesn't matter, but it really doesn't matter. And I think inflation at, say, 3.5% is really a benign backdrop for corporate earnings, allowing companies to have the ability to raise prices a little bit and keeping those high margins. I think that's what the market's looking at rather than what the Fed is doing or thinking about.
In that case, what are we going to learn from earnings this week? In that year to date, you got energy and financials are number 2 and 3 in terms of sectors best performing on the S&P. Communication services, number 1, but you could argue that's a Meta and an Alphabet thing. And tech comes in at number 4. Is it going to be cyclical leadership? Will that actually happen? Will the earnings deliver?
Well, I think all those sectors that you said are economically sensitive. And so they have all reflected, frankly, a better economy. Last week's earnings were better than the market expected. And we'll see this week if, again, we have better than expected. I expect that we will. And so I think that that's really what the market's telegraphing. When you have those sectors that are sensitive, even financials, energy, that says to me that the market is not worried about economic growth. It's looking at pricing power or a little bit of inflation.
Right now, we're speaking with Margi Patel, Portfolio Manager at Allspring Global. And coming up in just a couple of moments, we're going to listen into a Bloomberg Television interview of Lamborghini CEO Stefan Winkelmann. And Matt Miller is not here to participate in that. I know he's going to miss that. So, Margi here, what are the sectors we should be looking at here from as we think about the second half of this year? Where are you guys most enthused?
Well, again, we think economically sensitive sectors are going to do better for the year. So that would be technology. Certainly, it's been a volatile sector, but we still think there are plenty of very competitive companies who are not priced, say, too high that will perform better than the market. We also like industrials because we do think there's a capital expenditure cycle and expansion of manufacturing and investment by companies that will be very positive. Some of the materials, in fact, we think will benefit. And energy, which has rather been overlooked. Healthcare has been more a group of companies that's reacted to the downdraft after COVID and the drying up of money to be spent on tools and devices by a lot of the new companies. So we think healthcare is attractive still, but very selective, because some companies, say Lilly, for example, has a wonderful product. Some of the tools and devices companies have had disappointing earnings because of this dry up in funding, mm-hmm. and also because of a dramatic lowering of China sales.
Margie, you didn't mention tech. And so I assume that if you don't own tech right now, it's hard to buy it at these levels. But how big of a part should that be of your portfolio?
Well, really, when you look at technology, there are, first of all, many companies now pay competitive dividends, which they didn't used to do. And if you look at their price earnings ratio versus some sort of estimate of future growth, and then you look at other sectors, price earnings ratio, estimates of growth, it always seems to me that tech may be a little bit expensive on a price earnings ratio, but much higher sustainable prospects of growth. When you look at some sectors that are priced almost as high as tech, say consumer staples, really, I just don't see the growth there. I don't see the pricing power there. So in an uncertain world, it just says to me, technology is fairly valued, and it'll really depend on earnings. And so I think it'll continue to do better.
All right, Margie Patel, thank you so much. We appreciate that. Margie Patel, Senior Portfolio Manager at Allspring Global Investments, joining us via Zoom here.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Let's go to Apple for a second. So that stock is actually up by about 3%. It got an upgrade over at Bernstein. Bernstein apparently sees China issues as cyclical. But The broader headline was that the European Union took aim at Apple's iPad. It's been hit by its digital dominance crackdown. I don't really know what that means. But luckily, Anurag Rana does. He's Bloomberg Intelligence technology analyst. He joins us now. Anurag, what does that mean, that the EU's digital dominance crackdown hits the iPad?
Yeah, to be very honest, it's not much, frankly. Only because the EU wants to make sure that these ecosystems or the operating systems are open and allow third-party apps and, you know, the opening of the payment system, etc. Apple's already said they're going to do this for the iOS, for the iPhone. So which is a bigger deal? And now they have to do this for the iPad operating system too, which they're going to do anyway. I mean, it's not going to be a big deal, again, mathematically, because as you know, iPad revenues are tiny compared to what they generate from the iPhone. So the services associated with iOS, iPhone, is far bigger than the services associated with iPads. So in our view, not a big deal, but you know, we follow whatever the news says.
All right, Anurag, a big 7 or 8 days coming up here for Apple. Thursday, they report their earnings, and next Tuesday, they have their, developer conference on the 7th. Let's start with the earnings. What can they say, or what does the market want to hear about China, about what type of headwind it will be and for how long?
So if you hear the word China stabilizing, good. If you say China still bad, not good.
Okay.
That's it. I mean, there's not a whole lot other
that?
Than... that those are the only two things you'd be looking for, because the AI stuff's not going to happen for another month or so when they do the developer conference back next year in June. The May event is about the iPads, the new iPads coming out, which is, again, exciting, but, again, not a needle mover financially.
Yeah, I was going to say iPad, okay, fine. What did you make of this Bernstein upgrade? So they upgraded the Apple target to outperform from market perform. They have an unchanged price target of $195. But the reason behind it I found interesting. They said the China weakness, they see it as more cyclical than structural. And they say that overall, Apple's business in China has just been more volatile than the wider company. And everything's kind of already priced into that point. Do you agree with that based on your research?
See, one of the things I would agree is, yes, it is cyclical. But one of the things I don't know is how far is the bottom for these, you know, we're going to see a double-digit decline in China. Right? This is going to happen. Now, I do not know whether next year we're going to see the same thing or not, because, you know, what is going to drive that iPhone cycle in China if things are still weak, if consumers are still weak, and Xiaomi is still giving them a hard time. So I think it's tough to time when this thing is. But I do believe that Apple's a premier brand, and people are not getting rid of it to the sake of something else. The Xiaomi phone just came out after a very, very long break, and which is what doing. I apologize, Huawei phone, not Xiaomi.
So we had Dan Ives on earlier today on surveillance, and no surprise,
bullish
about AI and Apple's ability to capitalize on AI, despite the fact that they really do not have any dedicated offering, it appears, to most investors. How do you think about Apple and AI? Will they at some point become an AI play for investors?
So I think the most important thing is when they announce in June, is it going to be a tie-up between them and Google again, or are they going to license some technology from OpenAI, or are they going to build something in-house? I think the in-house is probably the weakest at this point, because, you know, if they would have had something, they would have already talked about it. And the second thing is they're just pushing a lot of resources in the last 6 months, and it's not easy to come up with those things. But I think I'll feel far more comfortable if they announced a deal with Google and say, we're going to license some of Google's technology to build our own products or improve our products with that technology, because they already have a deal with them on the search side of things. So that would make me more comfortable than them trying to push out some of their own stuff.
Would you categorize as Apple being behind AI, or is this just what Apple does? Like, they let everyone else kind of front run a little bit, they see where the good and the bad are, and then they kind of make their own decisions.
And I would say almost everybody was caught off guard with OpenAI, and I would say Apple was behind.
That's
so
not good.
Again, but if you're Apple, you're not behind in very many things for a very long period of time.
Right.
I mean, do you envision AI becoming as a big part of the Apple story? Because one could argue without it, it's a lot less attractive.
No, I completely agree with you. In this particular case, what could happen is, let's say you build a lot of the Gen AI features or search features within the actual iOS, or, you know, you would ask Siri that question that currently you go into an app and you input that information and then get it. But what if you were able to do it just on the operating system? And I think that is a powerful way of solving that problem. But again, you need to have the technology to do that.
What else is on your docket this week? What else is front and center for Anurag?
I think Amazon announcing tomorrow night is a very big deal. I think that's going to tell us whether Amazon's going to surprise us on the cloud side or not, because we've seen Google's done well, Microsoft's done well. And if Amazon does not perform, it's going to raise all sorts of questions if they're losing market share, if Google's ahead, if Microsoft's already, you know, showcasing its AI products. So I think it's really focuses on Amazon, in my view, more than honestly in Apple at this case.
All right, so I think the one of the questions here, Anurag, is just technology in general. I mean, and it's all about AI. And the question I have is how much of this incremental, or how much of this AI spending, which has gotten people so excited about any company who has any exposure to AI, how much of that do you think is incremental? If I'm spending on AI, for example, am I taking money just from my IT budget?
This is the single most important question for this year. And for what we have seen, it's more of a transfer of budgets at this point. Because when you see results from Accenture or IBM, you see consulting being really weak. So people are taking money from that bucket and putting it in, you know, hardware or AI-related hardware. Now, we think it's going to drive incremental spending. It is, I mean, driving it, but at the expense of consulting. But we think it's going to come back, and it may come back next year.
That's interesting. So it's like one big pot that's just kind of moving around, and then how you wind up playing it. Is there any indication that Amazon's cloud won't be good in the same way that Google's was and Microsoft was?
Well, there are certain, you know, you could see the tea leaves is the way we want to think about it is Microsoft did well because it had its OpenAI relationship. Amazon does not have that. Amazon's selling a lot of the nuts and bolts at this point, and it's really large. In terms of size, it's the biggest cloud of all. So maybe it takes them another two or three quarters to get that big push on AI, and they are still stuck in the old non-AI technology. But I think that's really, they have to come out and prove that they are a viable player, you know, in the current status. In the long run, I'm very certain that Amazon will get the benefits of a lot of incremental spending on AI.
All right, good stuff, Anurag Rana. Thanks so much for joining us. Anurag Rana, he's a technology analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us from Chicago. So we got, you know, we have Apple Thursday after the close, Amazon, I guess, Tuesday after the close. A couple other big prints coming out of technology. I would say some of the technology numbers have been good kind of so far this quarter. So it'll be up to these two big guys to continue, because it just feels like when you look at this market, if technology is not working for you, where does the market go?
Industrials and energy. I mean, if you, like I mentioned earlier, like if you look at year to date, it's communication services, then it's industrials, then energy, then tech. And the communication services is a Google and Amazon story at the end of the day. So you have to wonder, can the cyclicals really take control? Which leads me to energy and the idea that how many energy stocks do you actually want to own?
Right.
Or is it just going to be the big guys and the rest of them are going to be scrambling? Anyway.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
So we want to talk the fixed income market coming up, but I'm just looking at the news. Boeing announced today they look to sell bonds after reporting a cash burn. They want to do about $8 billion of a deal here. And I just see another Bloomberg story coming across just recently. Boeing sees $77 billion in demand for its six-part bond sale. So even after that really tough quarter, it just shows you how strong the corporate bond market is and how much they're looking for bonds to invest in. So that's a perfect time to bring in RJ Gallo, Senior Portfolio Manager of Fixed Income at Federated Hermes, joining us from Pittsburgh via Zoom. I'm sure a phone call went in from the underwriters into Federated Hermes for some Boeing bonds, but boy, RJ, it just shows the demand out there and the strength of the corporate bond market, doesn't it?
Yeah, corporates have done very well this year. High yield in particular on a total return basis. Issuance of IG has also been very strong. I think the fact that the economy has proven to be much more resilient than many would have expected in the face of a Fed funds rate between 5.25 and 5.50 has underpinned strong demand for corporate credit risk. Fundamentals are good. Earnings have been generally favorable. Obviously, there's some concerns now as the Fed has pushed back on the prospect of rate cuts. What's next? But the theme year to date has been resilience in the face of a tight Fed. And that has certainly underpinned strong demand for corporate credit.
So would you take credit risk or duration risk then? Or I don't know, like both?
You know, it's funny that you say that. For our investment process, we sort of break things up into, you know, sort of different components of a fixed income portfolio. We deliberate on duration, yield curve, and what we'll call credit or sector, the allocation of a multi-sector portfolio across different portions of the bond market to include, say, treasuries, investment-grade corporates, high yield, emerging markets, et cetera. And our playbook year to date has been one of somewhat low conviction on the rates side with respect to duration. We're neutral at this point in time. We think that means that there's symmetric risk that yields could rise or fall from here. That's proven to be a fairly safe place to be. We're not adding alpha by being neutral, but we have been more constructive expecting yields to fall at the beginning of the year. And the simple resilience I was just mentioning has made that not the case. With respect to credit risk, we've been a little up in quality into places like mortgages. We like the valuation in mortgages better than we do in investment-grade corporates and high yield. We're somewhat underweight investment-grade corporates and a little bit more underweight high yield. We own them, but we're below the universal index in terms of our allocations to corporate credit risk, in part because of the strong rally has driven valuations to a place where we feel like there's not a lot of upside left from here. You know, that's not calling for panic or recession, but we think there's opportunities for spreads to widen on event risk or volatility, and we revisit those underweights in that time frame.
All right. So, I mean, what should I do here? Should I go buy a 2-year treasury darn near 5%, or should I take that phone call from my Citigroup salesman who's trying to sell me some of this Boeing paper here? Do I take the credit risk just by and large?
It's a great question. I think that it's important you think about asset allocation to step back a little bit. There's a lot of question right now about where are equilibrium yields? Where is the Fed going to tell us in the next summary of economic projections? Where do they see the long run Fed funds rate? Where is our star? And our star, you know, conceptually should give some underpinning to bond investors in terms of expectations of where yields will be pulled to over an economic cycle. When you don't have a lot of confidence about our star, it makes it a little bit harder tactically to say, yeah, the bond market looks real cheap right now. Let's add duration. Let's add interest rate risk to our portfolio. And, you know, in that context, that's why being at neutral is sort of dissatisfying as a bond investor. It's almost like you don't have a view on the market. But one thing we do have are some of the highest yields in 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I am one who believes that our star is probably not 2.5. It's not 5 either. I wouldn't be surprised that the Fed is increasingly going to be migrating their long run dot upwards.
Mm-hmm.
That suggests that yields won't probably go as low prospectively as they have in the past, say, 10 years, certainly outside of the context of crises like a pandemic. What does that mean to a bond investor? Well, it suggests to me that the Fed funds rate north of 5, money market yields north of 5, that's a good place to be for your very risk-averse investor. But for someone with a little bit of a longer-term horizon, the bond market's valuation, the level of yields has been restored to a point where you can add duration to your portfolio and take some more balanced investing as opposed to, do I own cash or do I own stocks?
Mm-hmm.
Bonds are sort of back in the sense that they have a role in a diversified portfolio because they have been reset higher in yield, even if I don't know those yields will go down in the next 3 months.
It's such a good point, which leads me to the refunding announcement. So we're going to get the amount today and then where Treasury will issue on Wednesday. And then just hours later, mm-hmm. we'll get questions on, will the Fed back off on quantitative tightening? What do you think the combined effect of all of this is going to be?
Well, I think the Yellen Treasury has been pretty careful. The amount that's being financed is near record proportions, I think, only surpassed by the depth of the pandemic and the borrowing that was going on at the time. As a result, they've relied a lot on the short end of the curve. With short yields being high and money market balances being astronomically high, I think they're at a record. There's plenty of demand at the short end of the curve. I don't expect any sharp turns away from that strategy in the upcoming announcement. I do think the Fed's QT program, you know, we're getting closer and closer to the point, and the Fed has telegraphed this, where they're going to want to slow down the pace of balance sheet reduction, slow down the pace of QT, I think, as it's come to be called. which is a rational thing to do. As much as there's uncertainty about our star, there's also uncertainty about the right level of reserves in the system. And the Fed doesn't want that uncertainty to sort of spill over into financing market pressures, which is what happened the last time they were trying to reduce their balance sheet. So I think both parties, the Treasury and the Fed, have been very careful about these key variables, how much the Treasury is borrowing and where on the curve, and how the Fed is going to alter their balance sheet. I don't think either one of these is apt to be very market moving right now because of the sort of deliberation and the signaling that has gone on both from the Treasury and the Fed on both of those fronts.
All right, RJ, I'm going to jump in front of Alex here. I know she wants to ask about this. How about municipal bonds?
I miss the muni segments, exactly. Man.
Exactly. How do you think about munis in this environment here?
Well, yeah, munis have the absolute yield argument has motivated many investors to buy bonds in general, certainly on the corporate bond side and also on the muni bond side. Investors have been putting money to work into SMAs. The mutual fund flows on the muni side are positive. They're not huge, but they're meaningfully positive. I think the point I was making a few moments ago about relatively high yields and restoring fixed income as a component of your balanced diversified investment strategy, it resonates with people. And you can see that in the behavior in the muni market. Interestingly, however, that has meant that munis have held up better on a year-to-date basis. So for example, if you look at the Bloomberg Muni Bond Index on a year-to-date basis, I'm getting an updated number here, it's down 1.7% in total return. At the start of the year, we expected that would be positive by now. So that's been a little bit of a setback. But that's still a lot higher than the Treasury Index, which is down 3.2%, or the aggregate index, which is down 3.2%, just about the same. You know, why is that? Well, munis have outperformed given that strong demand. And the muni market is underpinned right now by the fact that the value of the tax exemption goes up at today's higher yields relative to the last decade when yields were much lower. So tax-exempt income has helped to attract investors into the muni space who might not be so worried about whether yields are going up another 30 or 50 basis points or down 30 or 50. They like the valuation in a longer-term sense in the here and now. And the credit story is good. Muni's credit story has been very fundamentally strong given the economic expansion and sort of the long tail of some of the fiscal transfers that went from federal to state and sort of bleed through the muni credit system. That's still very much a positive dynamic there as well.
All right, RJ, a great overview. As always, really appreciate getting some of your time. RJ Gallo, Senior Portfolio Manager over there at Federated Hermes. See, municipal bonds can be cool.
Muni's cool. Muni moment cool.
Exactly. Joe Mysak, very cool.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
From Alex Steele alongside Paul Sweeney, this is Bloomberg Intelligence Radio. We cover all the news for you through our lens of our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts who cover 2,000 companies, 130 industries around the world. Also, once a week on Mondays at this time, we're also going to bring you the perspective from our great analyst over at Bloomberg NEF. It started off as Bloomberg New Energy Finance. They're basically a huge data provider on everything that concerns energy, from wind to solar, to oil, to gas, to coal, to EVs, to carbon credits. I mean, anything you need to know within energy space, they provide amazing data for.
Oh, you like these guys then.
I like see these what's guys. Happening here. This is my jam. The news from last week that I did find interesting that I did key in on is that a bunch of panel makers and polysilicon producers are trying to get tariffs increased for equipment coming from Southeast Asia. Basically, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of equipment coming on. Solar cells and modules are coming on, and that is lowering the price of those, which are then hurting U.S. companies. The problem is you kind of need all that stuff if you want to greenify or decarbonize your economy quickly. So let's get to some of the analysis here. Joining us now is Paul Licenzo. He is Bloomberg NEF Senior Associate. Can we impose tariffs on the stuff we need to decarbonize?
Well,
quickly, to decarbonize quickly.
We should not. The U.S. has been doing it for a while, actually very quietly, since 2012. So it's not a new thing. And it's really made solar more expensive in the U.S. and everywhere else in the world. So the difference is the U.S. has had very generous subsidies for solar for a long time, and that offsets some of those higher input costs. But is it the most efficient way if you're trying to decarbonize quickly and grow a sector quickly? Probably not.
So what are we talking about here? The panels, the more than the panels, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, we're talking mostly cells and panels.
So the panel gets the sun, converts it, or puts it into a, where does it go from there?
Correct. It goes into an inverter, which is the brains of the system, and the inverter translates that direct current power that the panels produce into alternating current power, which is the one that we use.
Thank you for explaining. Because I represent like 99% of our listeners.
This is true. Sorry about that. Yes. Yeah. So what part of that would be taxed with a tariff?
The panels. But what typically those tariffs target are the cells, which is the cells is essentially what composes those panels. You stack them together and you assemble them. Because the cells is really the true technological component of the panel. The panel is just like cells assembled, basically. So what the U.S. is trying, or what some of these companies are trying to do, is impose a new set of tariffs on, like, there's already tariffs on panels coming from Southeast Asia, and there will be new tariffs coming in June. But this would be an additional set of tariffs that they're trying to impose.
Why can't these companies, like First Solar or something, make these panels themselves?
They do. First Solar sits in a different league. First Solar has a different technology. This, we're talking about crystalline silicon technology. First Solar uses a different type of technology called thin film. First Solar has been producing their own panels for a long time, and they have really ambitious plans in the U.S.
But I guess that's the point, right? Because they don't want the cheaper ones coming in and then diluting what they're able to sell. So why can't, I guess the better question I should have is, why can't they make it for as cheap as the ones that Southeast Asia is selling for?
Yeah, the question is probably, the answer is not going to surprise you. Just higher input costs, higher production costs, higher labor costs. You cannot really reach the same scale that you can in the Asian countries in the U.S. It's not just about the factory that you have, where you assemble or making the cells or making the panels. It's about all of the adjacent supply chain. And China and some of these Asian countries, and by extent from being so closely to China, they are able to ramp up all of the adjacent supply that they need in a very efficient way. So typically, those mega bases in China have massive solar factories. And if you go across the road, that's where your aluminum frame supplier is going to be. If you go in a little bit further down the road, that's where your glass supplier is going to be. So it works in coordination quite nicely, and that helps improve efficiencies and lower costs.
It doesn't seem high tech to me. Why would I care if China's producing them, other than if at any time they could stop producing them and screw us. But I mean,
because you're saying that there's no like cybersecurity or security measure for that.
Don't I just want the cheapest panel?
That's correct, and that's exactly what we've been trying to say for a long time. Solar manufacturing is a terrible business to be in. It's really fierce. Competition is really fierce. We're typically go through all these swings of overcapacity, a bunch of bankruptcies, and then new companies arise from nowhere, and there's again overcapacity. So the IP and really that the technological know-how there is really not that difficult, and we don't understand why you would want to throw so much money at building this industry in the US, unless it's a geopolitical hedge, which is something that obviously begs a very different question and a very different set of analysis.
What kind of, let's say that these tariffs do go through, so this request could raise the prospect of tariffs as high as 271.5% later this year. Let's just pretend that happens.
Yeah.
And I want to install a solar panel on my house in Massachusetts. What's that going to cost me now?
It's going to cost you a ton more money.
A ton. I don't like a ton.
No. I mean, the 271% is very unrealistic. Mm-hmm. So what happens typically in these petitions is a little bit of the boring stuff. But what happens is they file this petition, and then if the U.S. Agrees to investigate these companies, or these, they open their books, the companies open their books, and they have to prove that the amount of subsidies that they receive is not as high as what that countrywide tariff would look like. So typically they get a tariff rate that is much lower than the 271% that you're referring to. And it can range from like 30 to 50%. It just really depends. But the bottom line is, if that were to happen, obviously imports from Southeast Asia would be completely ruled out in the US. And that would really trigger the renaissance of the U.S. manufacturing industry, but you would have to pay more for your panels.
Just real quick, 30 seconds, what percentage of our panels here in the U.S. come from China today?
About, from China, zero.
Okay.
So the U.S. has been singling out China for a long time.
Okay.
Southeast Asia, more than 80%.
More than 80%.
Yeah.
And these tariffs are just for China or for all of
them? For Southeast Asia, for Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, and Cambodia, which represent that 80% number that I just quoted.
Paul, thanks a lot. This is really interesting stuff. And it's just that when you want to put a solar panel on your house, there's a lot more that goes into it. And if you want to sort of decarbonize quickly, why wouldn't you want the cheapest available, Paul, to your point? All right, thanks a lot. Really appreciate that. Paul Lescano joining us from Bloomberg NEF.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.